Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to Deep Thoughts. Today's episode is brought to you by La Pluma. These are great sticks. About a 45-minute burn time. The flavor is insane. For a new world, no complaints. Construction's great. Burn is great. I've been smoking these in between shows. So I find myself turning down my gain on my box a lot. I find myself referencing a few movies all the time in my lifetime. And I think that the best way for me to describe this is to say there are certain movies that in my family, which for me was really my dad and I, is after about 10, he and I lived together until I was 16, so about 6 years. But then before that even, there was probably at least 3 years of full-blown consciousness I had where movies are considered heirlooms to the family. We watch them over and over and over again, and they're just phenomenal, and they come with gifts that you can think about your entire lifetime. At least my brain loves these gifts. And so I thought I would review with you fairly quickly a series of films that are heirlooms in my family. Most of them are sci-fi. Now, it doesn't mean that I'm going to mention every movie that's an heirloom in my family, because there are plenty. But I want to talk about the ones that are sort of forgotten, because that's important. If I said, hey, we're going to talk about Blade Runner, I did a whole episode on Blade Runner. I am going to cover one film that I think is forgotten that I did a whole episode on. But there's some others. I've mentioned them to you from time to time. I'm going to try to tease you with enough information to want to go see these films. Most of the guys who are at least 40 or above, definitely 50 or above, have seen these films probably numerous times. But I bet I've got one you haven't seen out of the whole bunch. I'll mention it when it comes around. But for those of you who've seen them, you know they're special. And they touch you for the rest of your life. And science fiction is very interesting that way, because it's not supposed to be capable of doing that, even though that's the goal of every writer. And these films were cult classics, every single one of them. But people don't know that they exist. And when you pull them out with your friends and you're like, hey, have you seen this? You get about 50-50. People going, yeah, oh, hell yeah, definitely. Throw it in there, man. No one has any complaints. They're like, throw it in there, man. Wait a minute. Let me get a drink. Let me get something to eat. Let me smoke my weed, whatever it is. I'm going to start back in 1951. It's a movie called The Day the Earth Stood Still. And it was remade with the brilliant actor Keanu Reeves. I don't think he really had a script that was worth doing, but, you know, I wouldn't turn it down if I were him as well. You never know. You never know what's going to happen in a movie. You read a script, and you may think it sucks, but you're thinking, well, surely they're going to rewrite the ending. You know, surely post-production, they're going to figure out this thing has weak points, and it'll all work out in the end. And then it stays exactly the same, and you get to the end, and you're like, oh, God, I did that film. But The Day the Earth Stood Still, from 1951, stars an actor, Michael Rennie, R-E-N-N-I-E. Brilliant, refined, amazing actor. Without this guy, it would have been hard to have the character that we're going to have, that we're going to talk about in this film. The film starts out with a UFO, a plain old-fashioned flying saucer, except that it doesn't have a completely round bottom. It actually has a kind of a flat disc bottom, and then it kind of comes up and does the UFO thing. And it's typically bigger than most of the UFOs. And they did this great optical effect of overexposing film so that the spaceship is like white hot as it's going around the world. It's being reported in every country, which was kind of interesting. They took the tack that it does have a global interest. And this is before The Twilight Zone did the episode To Serve Man, which also had a global element to it, where they were constantly reporting in from all the different countries that were, you know, at least first world level countries. But this thing comes and flies around the world, letting everyone know it's here, and it lands in a baseball field in Washington, D.C. And it lands during the day. And so the army shows up, citizens show up. They've got the place cordoned off, but everyone's pretty close to it. You know, it's got this whole thing cordoned off. It's gorgeous. The spaceship is from 1951. Wow. Beautiful. And it's mainly beautiful, not only by its shape, but the way this door opens up on the front of it is just brilliant how they did this sliding steel-looking stuff. The whole thing's made of wood in real life, but they slid this thing out, and this door comes across, and out comes this giant robot named Gort. You won't know his name's Gort, maybe even the whole movie, unless you pay attention to a couple references here and there. But he comes out, and it's a big steel robot, a big rubber costume. They built two suits. There was a zipper down the front of one of them when they had to film him from the back, and a big zipper down the back. And if you watch carefully, you can see the zipper. It's kind of cool. But that's not what makes it amazing. Out walks a humanoid. I mean, the robot's fairly humanoid too, right? Two legs, two arms. There's this amazing, like, visor thing that lifts up, and it's just being cool. It's like, it's the protector. He stands aside, and here comes this humanoid, I mean, in a space suit, has an interesting mask on. That was probably definitely a plot mechanism to make everyone worried. And there's some sort of, you know, low-end military person. The president doesn't show up. Five-star general does not show up. It's kind of funny because it's just happening. Just happening, you know. The lead character walks out, Klaatu. And he steps to this authority figure, and he's got this little thing in his hand. And he holds it up, and he's offering it to the guy. The problem is that the thing expands, and so it creates these little prongs sticking out. And there's a bunch of, like, gung-ho soldiers just came out of World War II, and, you know, they're used to life-threatening situations, and here's this alien coming out of a freaking spaceship. And as soon as the thing pops open, one of the guys shoots it with a .45, destroys the thing in his hand, falls on the ground. The guy, you know, oh, God, you know, he kind of wrung his hand pretty hard, and he sort of, you know, leans over. And then Gort's like, what? You shot at my dude? Visor comes up, and pow, 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 pow. This dude shoots every weapon, and everything melts. All of the tanks melt. So guys are jumping out of their tanks. The guns get shot. The jeeps get shot. Everything gets shot. And just melts to the ground. Everyone's safe. But Gort's, he's got to tell Gort to stop because Gort's about to fuck everything up hardcore. Gort's amazingly designed. I mean, just formidable as hell. You're scared of the guy because he's got a, sort of some unknown thing, right? But that's just the first scene to get you enticed. Now, the other thing that's going on in the film is that there's a theremin, which is a very interesting instrument that is using electromagnetic waves to create sound waves. And it was sort of a weird gimmicky thing that just made sound, but one guy in Hollywood figured out how to play this theremin. And he is, I think, credited with being the only guy that actually used the theremin professionally to create anything that sounded like music. So the soundtrack of this whole movie is very, very unique. Very unique. I believe he was going to be on the next film, too, that I'm talking about. Did some theremin work. So the whole thing's ominous and strange. But the reason why the film takes off is that the alien is captured, and he knows it's all part of the game. He's not stupid. And he gets interrogated, and you find out when they took his suit off, he just looks like a human being. He looks like my uncle. It's really funny. And he's trying to say, that thing you just shot out of my hand is a device with, like, libraries and libraries of things in it that would have cured all of your problems, all of your illness, all of your irrigation issues, agricultural issues, manufacturing issues. And you idiots just shot it. Doesn't call him anything like that. The rapport of this actor is top-notch. He's a first-class human being. And so it comes through in the character in the movie beautifully. And so they're dealing with a super-intelligent being, and this actor plays it perfectly. But eventually he escapes his captivity, and he ends up taking up room and board in a boarding house where a lot of people live. Sort of what happened back in those days. You get a brownstone and you have a lot of rooms in it. You just rent a room. And one of the rooms has a mother and a son. And I can't remember how they alienated the father away. I think he maybe died in the war or something, but the kid's father is no longer alive. And so the mom's trying to date. She's got a good suitor who comes and visits. But here comes this dude, and he's in there, and he's eating dinner with these people, and they have no idea that he's the alien that escaped. It's going on the radio, and they're all kind of freaked out. And he's trying to calm him down, but of course he doesn't want to give away the fact that he's the alien. And the little boy takes a super shine to him. And so he's like, well, mom's got to go off and go to work. And he's like, well, you mind if I take Bobby out, or Billy out, one of the two? That's Bobby. Takes Bobby out, and, you know, they go see movies, and they chill out. And he's having the kid kind of show him around town, because he's like, wow, why not see humanity through a child's eyes? Isn't that beautiful? Today would be utterly frowned upon, of course. There's a lot of funny little things where the guy needs money to pay for something, and he's like, well, I don't have any money, but I've got these. Are these good for money? And he holds out his hand, and there are diamonds in his hand. And the kid's like, oh my God, it's probably worth $100, you know. And so this progresses, but the movie's called The Day the Earth Stood Still. So what's that all about? For those of you who haven't seen it, he is trying to get the world to pay attention to him for 1 second. And then if he can get the whole world to get on the same frequency of consciousness, then perhaps the world has a chance. And so he goes back to his spaceship and he sets up a little timer. And it makes everything stop. All engines, all electricity stops. Now, they don't explain that what happens to airplanes and things that are in, you know, a moment of peril. They don't talk about patients that need machines or they're going to die. So they just kind of, you know, suspension of disbelief there. But he ends up in an elevator with the mother. And he tells her, you know, it's almost 12 o'clock, 12 p.m. So it's about to occur. And then, boom, the elevator stops. And they're in there. And I can't remember how long it lasts, but it lasts quite a while. Now, that's the setup I'm going to leave you with. It's a 1951 movie, so it has a really good ending. Films didn't get made back in those days, nor become cult classics without great endings. There's more gore, too. But the interesting thing about this was that it tried to show us the contrast between humanity being so gung-ho and an intelligent being that has the intellectual power to develop equipment and machines and transportation to get from wherever they are to wherever we are in a heliocentric space world, of course. And how we can just be ignorant. And if you think about it, there's a huge theme and archetype of that problem in today's society. We have solutions for things lying everywhere. We have medium intellectuals that could solve 80 to 90% of the world's problems before we even get to our super geniuses. We don't need oil. There's 100 zero-point energy systems that have been discovered, used, filmed on TV. Jack Nicholson was working on some hydrogen stuff. Was it Stan Myers had a water system, fracturing system, made hydrogen out of tap water. He drove clear across the United States twice. They challenged him, so he kept getting it better. Better and better and better. Tesla, he was about to give us all free energy out of the world's interior plasma core. And so this film, outside of just being brilliantly shot, great soundtrack, it doesn't have the pound-for-pound Michael Bay sci-fi stuff like spaceships and robots everywhere and that kind of thing. It has one ship, one robot, and one alien. And the alien looks human. But if you pay attention, he is definitely not human the way he acts. The way it's written, it's beautiful. And there's some interesting characters I even told you about that get involved, which are really cute. So if you haven't seen The 1951, The Day the Earth Stood Still, and I believe you can get it on Netflix, if not all the time, frequent enough that just pay attention to it throughout the year. Hell, it's probably on YouTube. I don't think anyone's trying to hold out on the royalties for that one at this point. But now fast forward 5 years, going to our next film, a film I mention all the time throughout episodes. It is a landmark science fiction movie. And when I say landmark, I mean in every dimension of everything that we would ever itemize as a science fiction film. Remember, science fiction is supposed to be realistic. It has a little bit of fantasy in it. But the spaceship that you're going to see, which is in the opening credits, and again, it has a just incredible soundtrack. It's in color. It's in amazing color. 1951, Day the Earth Still is in black and white.
The second movie is Forbidden
Planet. Believe it or not, we knew Leslie Nielsen in this world as a comedian. He was in all the airplane movies. He was in the Naked Gun series. He's in just countless comedies. But in this film, even though he has some comedic lines, he is a very serious captain of a spaceship. But now the spaceship is careening through space. It's an original design. It's very flying saucer-like. It's the one we all drew in the 70s. Little bubble in the center with a little disc on the outside. Has a pretty hefty crew in it. I don't know how many people are in it, but it's quite a few. I'd say 30 to 50, somewhere in there. They probably say it in the film, but I just forgot about it. It came out in 1956. It has the gentleman who was on Charlie's Angels, the guy that actually was the mediator between them and the speaker, where Charlie was on the speaker. It has that dude in it. It's probably his first role. He does kind of an abysmal job acting, but God bless him. But it has some classic actors from that time, and a lot of them, in fact, two of them are in Twilight Zones right off the bat, but it's the debut of Robbie the Robot as well. The story is about a ship that is going to a planet where a colony had landed previously, 20 years ago, and they never reported back. And so they're flying by, and they're calling down to the ground to say, hey, we need, you know, clearance to land. And I should say, prior to them landing, there's a science fiction theory that they did where they're going so quickly that in order to slow the ship down, they can't have humans inside the ship in their human form, in their normal mass form, because the stop would destroy their bodies inside. They don't have inertial dampers, let's say. So they actually have to step on these pods. And it took me like 20 times seeing this film before I realized what the hell was going on. They step on these pods that are very similar to the transporter pods in Star Trek. And they're put into this atomized stage. They're all beams of energy. And while the ship slows down, and when the ship slows down, they turn back into humans, and that protects them from the slowdown. I mean, how brilliant is that? 1956. 1956. Brilliant, Ben. But they call down, they make contact with one of the settlers, and it's this guy playing Dr. Edward Morbius. M-O-R-B-I-U-S. And it's played by an actor who is just the same caliber as the guy that played in the Rennie guy from The Day the Earth Stood Still. His name is Walter Pidgeon. He has to play a character that has been on this planet for 20 years. He is a linguist. So already, the way he communicates has to be top-notch. He's a PhD linguist. But when you get further into the film, you will find out that he has boosted his IQ like 300+%. And so now the writers of this film have a character on deck that they have to write for that is not only a PhD linguist, but he's also boosted his IQ 300%. And I will tell you, for my money, there's not a word out of place. Every form of communication with this guy holds up 100%. It's amazing. But they show up and they land. And the landing sequence is legendary. This ship landing is the most beautiful in-camera compositing work you've ever seen for the 50s. It's what Ed Wood aspired to in all of his films. But they get out of their ship, start looking around. It's this sort of deserty sci-fi book cover from the 50s. And no sooner do they kind of like settle down, they look in the look off in the distance, and there's this crazy, super fast dust cloud coming, and it's like, you know, Mach 1 at least, And they're like, they're kind of freaked out. It's coming right at them. And as it comes at them, they pull out their guns, I believe. And it's Robbie the robot pulling this little carriage in the back with two seats. With these really cool plexiglass like reflectors in the front to deflect or deflectors to make sure that the wind doesn't blow you off the vehicle as he's driving this Mach speed, of course. And Robbie the robot waddles out of this thing. And of all the robots ever created in science fiction history until we got to really modern 70s stuff, I would say, Robbie the robot is ingenious. He looks a little goofy, but he was just head over heels better than the Lost in Space robot. Lost in Space robot looked like a toy, looked ridiculous. It didn't look inviting at all. It didn't look like it was made by somebody who had any style. And I apologize to people who made that, but Robbie's stuff was beautiful. And the suit that's Robbie the robot, I got to see as a kid in the Cars of Stars back in the 70s. And he's actually made of leather, but it looks like polished steel, like really thick steel. And I don't know how many movies he showed him up in after that, but this is the one. This is the one you want to see him debut in. But he has all these funny sayings because he's super duper strong. And so he's like, you know, I just lifted, 50 tons of steel this morning and I barely, you know, broke a sweat kind of thing. You know, he's really kind of funny. But he's come to pick them up because when they were calling down to the planet, Morbius is there saying, look, you don't want to be down here. You don't want to land. I don't want you to land. And they're like, I'm sorry, we traveled clear across the galaxy to get to you. We're going to land. We're going to find out what the hell happened to all the survivors. I mean, sorry, all the colony members. Who survived? What's going on? So eventually they kind of threaten him, and he gives them some coordinates, and that's when Robbie comes and picks him up. And they take him to this beautiful sort of George Jetson house. Except it's built. It's real. Morbius sort of reluctantly invites them in. Shows him his pad. It's beautiful. I mean, like, we should build this house, let me tell you. And it's three guys. And this is what's really huge. If you go see my Star Trek episode, and you haven't seen this film, you will have heard this pitch before. But it's the very first time a captain, a science officer, and a ship's doctor go out to see what's going on. And where did that get picked up? It got picked up by Gene Roddenberry brilliantly for Star Trek, which I think was 1966 or 67, 67, 68, 69, yeah. So, and he was writing it for a couple of years beforehand. But he loved that, and that's where he got that little combination. But you start hearing this engagement with this guy, and he is telling them basically the bare minimum that they need to know. He says that all the survivors died. They got in a ship and tried to escape. And the ship crashed, and so he had to bury all of them. He points off in the distance at this cemetery that he had to bury them all by himself. And they said, well, you married some woman? And he goes, yeah, check Judy so-and-so, whatever the person's name was, and she was on the crew. She was another PhD scientist. I married her. And then he had a kid. The daughter is played by Anne Francis. She plays Altera Morbius, and she was beautiful, let me tell you. And so these three guys are in the house. I think they're almost done with their conversation, then all of a sudden Altera shows up. And these guys haven't seen a girl in a really long time because they've been out on the ship, you know. And they're all like, boing, you know, their eyeballs are popping out of their heads. And, of course, Leslie Nielsen, he's got an eye for this girl, but so do the other two dudes. The doctor's actually pretty cool. But there's this other guy who's a big player. He tries to pull all kinds of shenanigans with her, try to trick her into all kinds of stuff. And Morbius did not want them to meet her because he's like, look, I don't want my kid wanting to go back with you, and I don't want you messing with her. And so they conclude their first meeting, and they go back to their ship, and they got to now report back home because they didn't intend on finding everybody dead. And so they don't know what to do. They don't have orders for that scenario, which is kind of weird. maybe they were all dead. There's orders, but because there's one guy there and he's got a daughter, and like, do we bring this guy back with us? What do we do? So in order to send a message back to Earth, they've got to disassemble the core of the ship to build a transmitter to get a message all the way back to Earth. And so there's this disassembly process. And by the way, the movie's got tons of comedy in it as well. It's not technically a comedy, but you're going to have a really good time with some of the stuff they do. I won't even ruin a single scene for you in that realm. But that night, when they all go to bed, after they've kind of done a little bit of disassembling, there is this, and again, the soundtrack to this thing is unlike anything you've ever seen in any film. It's so brilliant. And the effects for 1956 were at the very peak. I think it's an MGM film. But you hear these footsteps coming into the ship, and they do this thing with the ground. I'll let you see it when you see it. But it comes into the ship, and they show you it in various ways getting up the stairs. And then a guy screams. And I believe it's the Charlie's Angels guys that dies. But it destroys a piece of this communication capability so that it can't communicate. And so they go back to Morbius the next day, and they're like, what the hell? You didn't tell us there were creatures on this planet. And he's kind of being a little evasive. He's kind of like, well, you know, I told you, you shouldn't have landed, man. And then he kind of reveals a little bit more about the story. And he's like, you know, what's weird is my wife and I love this place. We wanted to stay, but none of the other people wanted to stay. And it's almost as if their hatred for this planet got them killed. And then we dig deeper and deeper. Now, I'm trying to figure out how to give you guys the beautiful gem of this film without ruining it for you, because it's in the third act. And you'll hear me talk about this all the time in the shows, so I don't want to necessarily do spoilers on every single one of these shows. I think it'd be better to entice you. But what they find out about this dude, this won't actually spoil the film for you at all, but they find out that this guy discovered the previous civilization that was on this planet. And because he was a linguist, he was the first guy that could start translating what the hell was going on. He found like rooms way down inside the bowels of the earth of this planet. And it's got the whole thing is like a big machine inside. It's crazy. And again, the sets are amazing. It's the first time you will see the Princess Leia machine that, you know, you're our only hope kind of thing. There's one of those projected in the movie, 1956, more than 20 years before Star Wars debuts. It's great. And it's done just as well as 1977. It's crazy. But the secret of what they find is utterly and it's just utterly profound. It's got to be one of the most profound turns of a science fiction film in history. And it will make you think about yourself when you're done. When you find out what they figure out, it will make you look at yourself differently to the degree you understand it. Now, I will say, as a child, I never got it. As an adult, I was like, because I'd seen it several times as a kid, and I'm looking at all the funny stuff and, you know, the goofy interactions and the spaceships and Robbie the Robot. Then I saw it in probably my 30s when I bought a copy of it, when it got to DVD, and I just watched the hell out of it. I think I bought it on iTunes as well, so I could see it anytime I wanted to. And my mind was utterly blown that I had missed this thing. Everyone else saw it as adults, right, back in the day. I would be very interested to hear how people reacted to this in 56, because this was deep. Okay. Very Freudian. But anyway, if you haven't seen Forbidden Planet, you owe it to yourself. If you're even the slightest Leslie Nielsen fan, you need to watch it. It's a beautiful achievement of his. But this Walter Pigeon guy, wow. His performance is second to none. Second to none. Okay, now we're going to fast forward quite a few years here. Now, I'm going to mention one that I've done an episode about. I'm going to get through it fairly quickly because the episode's out there. You can see it. But it's a 1975 science fiction film, Rollerball, with James Caan. If you consider yourself remotely, and ladies, this is for you too, remotely interested in being awake, Rollerball is a prophecy that is coming true right before your very eyes, especially with Amazon getting huge, Google getting huge, all these corporations getting huge, and they're trying to save humanity. They're trying to advance that narrative. You need to see it. But Rollerball is about the individual and the power of the human spirit. It is about the idea that no matter what you try to do to mankind, mankind will always prevail in the name of freedom. Because it is what God built us out of, the individual freedoms of man. Doesn't mean we can't work together, because this is a team sport. You're watching. But it's about a gentleman played by James Caan, who plays the character Jonathan E. And he plays a game called Rollerball. And this game is physical and real. There's no special effects in this movie whatsoever. It is all in camera. They built this beautiful, beautiful ring that is this Rollerball course. And it must have been pretty huge. It looks like what roller derby is today, but it's like science fiction and super serious. And they've got motorcycles with armor on them, guys with armor, spike gloves. I mean, it's like a death match on steroids, man. But it's not terribly bloody. But Jonathan E. is the best in the entire world, and he works for the Houston Corporation. The Houston Corporation controls all power. I don't know if for the world or definitely for its region, but it's got a orange dot as its symbol. The whole company's orange. Go figure. It's in this future where all the corporations run the world. There are no more countries. There are no more states. Corporations have removed all needs in the world. They've also tried to remove all individuality. Very much like the obsolete man from Twilight Zone in one way or another. But they ask him to retire. He plays this amazing game right at the very beginning of the movie. So you just have this hot, amazing intro with Toccata and Fugen and D minor by Bach at the beginning. Plays this amazing game. I mean, you almost want this game to exist minus the terminal violence that can exist if you take away the rules. But Jonathan plays great. This old man, who's the owner of the Houston, he's the CEO of the Houston Corporation. He owns the team. He comes in. He's kind of celebrating with the guys. And he says, you know, he just tells them they're all great and to keep going. And then he looks at Jonathan. He goes, come see me tomorrow. So he goes in to see the old man in this amazing office with all this hanging glass, which he cuts his finger on. And the old man says, we need you to retire. And he says, well, I don't understand. Why do you want me to retire? I'm still top of my game. He says, well, that's what we want for you, and you need to do what we say, and I don't know why you'd want to play this game in the first place. It's a barbaric game anyway. It was designed to teach the population the futility of individualism. And he can't, you know, he's just been a sports guy his whole life. He doesn't really understand intellectual thoughts yet. He's got a good mind, but he definitely doesn't understand this layer of the ruling class, which they call the executive layer. So the way the world works in this rollerball world is you have the people, you have the rollerballers, and you have the executives. And the old man lets him know, he says, you know what executives dream about? They dream about being great rollerballers. And do you know what rollerballers dream about? About being powerful executives. So you lived a damn good life, and you will be taken care of your whole life. You just need to retire. And James Caan plays, from start to finish, the most calm, cool dude you've ever seen in a film, going through the most intense midlife crisis you'll ever see. But he immediately tries to go out and find out, well, what's the deal? Why do they want me to quit? This doesn't make any sense to me. He was given the clue in the office, because you're getting too good. You are proving that there is power in the individual. So the movie goes on, and it is designed to, well, what ends up happening, just as a trailer, is that they keep squeezing him and squeezing him, and they keep trying to keep him out of the next game and the next game, and they keep reducing rules, and he suspects at one point they're trying to kill him. They get his girlfriend that he's been living with to leave. He calls on some of his closest friends to find out what the hell's going on, and no one can find out anything. One of the guys yells at him, "Why can't you just do what you're told?" Well, I'm going to give you the spoiler, a light spoiler that you know is probably coming in this because it got made. It's a movie. Jonathan wins. Humanity wins. The ending of this film, if you are really getting it, grokking it as they used to say, should reinforce everything we're doing in the truth movement, everything we're doing in the Great Awakening. And I would dare any grown man not to have a lump in his throat. I don't know what it does to the females, but every man out there listening to me who's ever said, "I will do whatever it takes to protect my country, myself, humanity in general, all other countries," this movie's for you, and it will reinforce you 10 to 1. You can watch it 50 times, and it'll still do the same thing to you. It's crazy. That was Rollerball 1975 with James Caan. Now we're going to fast forward. The next movie I've been talking about a lot was released in 1980. It's called Altered States. It stars William Hurt. Phenomenal actor. It's one of his first movies. And wow, what a first movie to be a part of, let me tell you. It's about a Harvard medical grad who is in search of the inception point of life. And he believes that in all mass and energy is the history that he's looking for. And he merely needs to kinetically go backwards. It'd be as if you took a pool table and you reversed it from every ball being in the pocket to being back out on the felt right to the break. He believes he can do that. And he is taking hallucinogenics, like ayahuasca-type drugs, putting himself in a deprivation tank. Some of you know what that is, some of you don't, but it's a blacked-out tank. You're floating in water. It's got a lot of salt in it, so you're very buoyant. You can go to most colleges and do this. But it shuts off all of your sensors. You wear little blinders on if there's lights in it. And you have no senses such that you have no outside contribution to senses. And so you have only yourself, your mental consciousness, and it starts imploding at a level that's, I guess, incredible. I've never done it. I'd love to do it. I'd love to do it on LSD, quite frankly, on a big-ass trip. I've never done ayahuasca, so I have no opinion about that. Some people smoke cigars in the dark. You may not know that, but they smoke cigars in the dark because they want the flavors to be the only thing that's happening. And so they get to see the cigar at a really intense dimension. The scientific dialogue in this film is phenomenal. For what it's trying to do, and the categories of dialogue that it's trying to tell, it is second to none. There have been no movies that even remotely come close to some of the philosophical monologues that go on in this film. You can just look up Altered States Monologue in YouTube, and you'll get a dialogue by William Hurt at a bar discussing the plot of the entire movie. Just it's in the film. I can get through this one fairly quickly by saying that he starts to succeed, but there's a catch. He wants to go back through the evolution of mankind, and it's an evolutionary type film, so for you folks and me, you know, you think we're either dropped off by aliens or God created us in a full state. Obviously, evolution has its problems, but, you know, go with it in this film because it has a very interesting epiphany at the end. And I've recently talked about the ending in an episode, so some of you know, but if you're coming into this fresh, I won't spoil it for you in this episode. But he starts having effects. He starts having physical effects. It's in the trailer, if you watch the movie. He starts regressing back while in this tank to prehistoric man. His bones change. And then he's sort of a He's married in the film. Actually, he marries this girl. He has some kids. And then he kind of gets estranged from her because he's like a Richard Feynman. He's just this handsome guy, and he's not really into women for the standard thing. He's literally having sex with his wife merely to have kids, and she talks about this. She has a beautiful dialogue about what it's like to have sex with him, because it's just, she goes something like, I don't know if I'm making love or being impaled by this man, you know, I mean, she just talks about it in such a psychological manner. It's really interesting. But he's off having sex with one of his students at his apartment, or hers, or whatever, and he goes to the medicine cabinet, or goes to the bathroom, or whatever, and he's looking in the mirror, and he realizes his arm is changing. And it's right when they came up with the bladder effect, where you could put a fake piece of skin on your arm, make, you know, with hair on it, and they could put a bladder underneath that had air bubbles in it, and they could squeeze these little air things, and it would start rippling on the side of the arm. It was a big deal back in the day, back in 1980. And so he's looking at his arm, he's like, oh my God, you know, look at this thing. And so that's pretty cool, the little special effect they did. But it goes further and further and further, and all I'll tell you, if I told you that he succeeded, which he does, he gets the answer, me not telling you the answer is the reason why you got to see the film. But it is just a one-off of amazing filmmaking. And that is Altered States from 1980. The next one up was made in 1983. It's Natalie Wood's last film. She died in that boat accident off of Catalina Island, literally like 25 miles from where I'm sitting, maybe 30 with my distance to the coast. And it has Christopher Walken. Natalie Wood and Christopher Walken are playing husband and wife. And the film starts out with him in a laboratory with about three or four people. It has the woman who plays Nurse Ratchet from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the beautiful Louise Fletcher. When she was young, she was very, really beautiful. She's an amazing actress. Everyone in this film is like at the top notch of their acting capabilities. But he has invented a mechanism that you can put on your head. And the very first one's really huge and ugly, and it has all these sensors on it and stuff. It looks kind of goofy. It's actually Christopher Walken wearing it is, I believe, the poster. But he is in this experiment where there's another guy in the other room doing stuff, and they're feeding him all kinds of weird food, and he's trying to see if he can feel it. And so he's in his side, and he's got this contraption on, and the contraption records all five senses of man, completely takes over your entire body. If the other guy's happy, or if he runs and he gets his heart rate up, your heart rate goes up just sitting there listening to it. And it records it on this beautiful tape that they invented for the show. It's like this wild magnetic tape with kind of the petroleum look on it. It's really super well done. But his wife is what we call a package designer. That's Natalie Wood. What she does is develop the molding around a particular object. So let's say someone creates a TV and they're like, okay, I need you to make this thing look pretty because people need to buy and put in their house. And so he comes to Natalie and he says, well, I think what we can do is we can take all these mechanics that are over the head and stick them in some suitcase or some off, you know, out of room machine. And then we can just run the cord straight to this thing and you can make a nice pretty one just where the sensors touch. Sounds a lot like the VR crap we have now, right? So she designs a beautiful version of it. And they're in the midst of this divorce. And there's one part I'm going to share because it won't change anything. But the what starts happening in the film is that Christopher Walken's character is sort of naive. He's like, hey, this is great, you know, and the military's interested. And Nurse Ratchet's older than him, and she's like, the military is going to take this thing over and they're going to do horrible things with it. So don't be so naive. Don't help them find out anything about what we're doing. Keep it all a big mystery to them. And of course, it's a devious government, beautifully played. There's this guy in this white suit who's just creepy as shit, man. And he's running the government side. And they start tapping into the laboratory. And so every feed that's going on in their laboratory, they've duped it in another room where they're listening. It's almost like the old police sting kind of thing, but it's this wild three-dimensional tape stuff, this five-sense tape. Well, the setup goes like this. This is why you want to see this film. Louise Fletcher's character is working at night, trying to work on something, and she has a heart problem. They've revealed this to you. They've also revealed that Walken's, you know, in this midst of this divorce, his wife is actually dating somebody else already, and he's kind of like, ah, damn it, that sucks. You're right. I got to see my wife at a party with this other dude, and I know the guy, and he's a jerk. And Walken just destroys this role. He's just amazing in this role, man. But Nurse Ratched is a smoker, and she's reaching for something in the middle of the night, and she hits her wrist on a soldering iron that's hot, burns herself. And the shock of that burn sends her heart into cardiac arrest. And she's got this little metal box with her pills in it. And she's got to get the box open and get a pill in her mouth and, you know, put it underneath her tongue where your salivary gland is, and it'll help her survive. But she drops the damn box. And she can't get down to it before the cardiac arrest kills her. She has a heart attack. But she puts the damn headset on and records it. The next day, the military uses her death to move in and sort of take over the whole thing, because they're like, okay, see how dangerous this is? And this little renegade laboratory is just, you know, doing stuff, and this woman died. It's just, it's a fake excuse, but that's what the government does, right? So Walken is sitting with one of these guys, one of his buddies. He says, help me, she was wearing this when she died? Yep. Help me play it back. Okay. Roll the tape back. He puts it on. Immediately, Christopher Walken starts having a heart attack. In the other room, where they're monitoring this, they have another guy listening in. This guy who was a part of their original team, who's kind of a scumbag, double-dealing backstabber, right? He's in the other room listening to the tape. Now, Walken, you know, they knock the thing off his head, and he's like, oh my God, my heart. The other guy keeps listening, and he is having a heart attack in the other room, and his government guys are just walking in the background talking, and he's just starting to have this heart attack, and the guy dies. And so they seize everything in the laboratory. He thinks he has some jurisdiction, but he doesn't. They seize the whole thing because the government paid for it, and they put it all the way in this deep laboratory somewhere with one of those robot arms that grabs tapes and puts it in a player and is all remote-controlled stuff. And they had built this suitcase version which could dial up through a modem and talk to the tape in some fantasy world where the bod was strong enough to send 5 senses, which is sort of funny. But now Walken says, what if we disconnect the respiratory thing? Take care of that sense. Get rid of it. Play the other 4 senses. And so the goal of the movie is Walken wants to play the tape. He wants to find out what happened with that machine on his head, on her head, right? Now I'm going to reveal one scene in the middle of the film simply because it won't affect the story at all. It's this weird subplot that's actually beautiful. But one of the things that Brainstorm has, and I want you to notice it when you see it, because it is something that I've never seen done before. I mentioned it in one episode previously. He's in the middle of this divorce with his wife. He's got a teenage son. And so, you know, in a divorce situation, half the time when you have relationship issues, it's just a breakdown of communication, right? And if you could just get the other person to see what you see, typically, you could resolve all your issues. But we don't have a mechanism to do that. We just have our words and you know, and then people don't know if you're lying to them, so your intent's always questioned. So he has this epiphany. They're living in this amazing house. They must have found this place. It was like some super eco-friendly house with like a pool that goes in and out of the house. And it's just an amazing place. But he's been forced to live in the downstairs area while she's living in the upstairs area. So it's the night that she's packing up all of her stuff to finally leave the house. Something he's dreaded. But he takes the suitcase, which is fully contained. It can record and play back all by itself. And he comes upstairs to Natalie Wood, who's just at the peak of her absolute beauty. I mean, that girl was phenomenally gorgeous, and she was just on her game when she died, unfortunately. But he walks up there, and she's like, what are you doing up here? You're not supposed to be up here. Get out of here. And he does the standard Christopher Walken thing, where he goes, shh, And he puts the suitcase down on the bed. And he pulls out the headset that she designed and he puts it on her head. And he pushes play. And then there's this gorgeous montage of their life. And she sits and watches it. It's every reason they discovered each other, fell in love with each other, appreciated each other. And despite his intense work habit, which has separated them, he still is able to communicate because all the senses are there. His love for her. The tape rolls out. It's over. And she's sitting there with his headset on, and she looks at him, and she goes, "I didn't know." Boom, they shack up that night, sleep together. The kid finds him under the sheets the next morning. They're like under with the light, the flashlight, reading books to each other and making love, and the kid's all happy that the marriage has been resolved. But that is a moment in time when science fiction met love story in a way that I have never seen it before. I mean, yeah, Luke Skywalker jumping across the cavern on a Tarzan wire, that's pretty good, but this one's better. This one's way better. But the ending of this film, I have told you nothing about. You gotta see it. Unbelievable. And that's one of the huge heirlooms of my family. The next one in the list is called Dreamscape. And this is the one that few people have ever seen. 1984. Dennis Quaid. The guy from Warriors who banged the little Miller light bottles together and said, "Warriors!" His name is David Patrick Kelly, and he plays a bad guy. What's Dreamscape about? Very simply, the CIA has discovered a method to, well, they've discovered individuals who have a talent to get inside your dreams. You think you're dreaming. They know they're not. And so they have, Dennis Quaid is one of the guys that can do it. And this David Patrick Kelly is the guy that can do it. Dennis is interested in obviously using it for good. And this Mr. Kelly guy, he's willing to do hitman kind of shit with it. And so the idea is you get next to someone who's sleeping. You have to be in the room next door, room underneath or above, and you can get into their dreams. So they set up the premise for this, and it's really cool. But now what's the plot? What are we doing here? Well, the President of the United States, played by this sort of good-hearted old, kind of Midwestern kind of guy, he is having nightmares of a nuclear apocalypse. And so he is wanting to disarm the United States of America during the Cold War, get rid of all of our nuclear weapons, leaving us prey to the Russians. And of course, the Central Intelligence Agency is not going to have that happen. And so they devised a plan to have this David Patrick Kelly guy go in and kill him in his dream. And of course, Dennis Quaid's character's like, "I got to save the president. I've got to show him that this is just a dream and that we do need our arsenal. So don't go crazy on us." Well, you can imagine that eventually the two guys meet in a dream, in the president's dream, and this man, this David Patrick Kelly guy, he was so on a roll, being such the pinnacle bad guy in the early 80s, man, late 70s, early 80s. He has a way of using your nightmares against you, and he can look at you and find your nightmares. I mean, it's just awesome. Just awesome. I found out that my writing mentor's former writing partner wrote that movie. Very cool. There's not a gigantic takeaway from that film. It is just that you do have to conquer your demons. You have to own your issues. You have to explore your issues because you can end up disarming, yourself out of some epiphany. And if you think about the way that the left extremist, left progressive nutbags in this world are trying to disarm the entire planet, trying to get all of our genders screwed up so we don't have any kids, trying to get us to surrender all of our guns. I mean, it's all developing these mental technologies to psych out human beings to give it all up. Every single horrible ruler in the world has done that just before they absolutely screw over their people. We can't afford to have that happen. So this film's got to kind of get that takeaway. The other one I'm going to end with, because there are other films, but I'm trying to go for films that people don't know exist. Now, if you're a flat earther and you haven't seen this film, then go spank yourself somewhere. This last film is called Dark City. And ironically, it has William Hurt in it from Altered States. It has Jennifer Connelly, Kiefer Sutherland, and a guy named Rufus Sewell, S-E-W-E-L-L. Don't know quite how to say his name. He's the main character, Rufus. But it's about a guy who works for a newspaper in this weird kind of Gotham city. Sort of like an amalgamation of every city that's sort of like New York. And it's nighttime in this city. And it's always nighttime in this city. And at night, well, everyone goes to sleep. It seems like everyone goes to sleep at the same exact time. And our main character doesn't go to sleep one night. I can't remember if there's something that happens to him or he doesn't go to sleep. There's little pills you're supposed to take, I think. But he stays awake. And when everyone goes to sleep, it's sort of like the day the earth stood still. Cars that are driving downtown, because there's no real distinction between day and night, because it's always night. That's why it's called Dark City. Cars just stop. People stop talking at dinner tables and in diners. It's sort of a bizarre timetable, too. It's like you sort of feel like you're in the 50s. That old famous painting of the diner, which I think has like Marilyn Monroe in it or something like that. It's sort of like that era. The world looks like that anyway. But the character, the main character, is looking around like, what the hell just happened? Why isn't anyone moving? And the only character he can find that's still awake is Kiefer Sutherland's character. Now, Kiefer Sutherland is sort of a weird guy. He's like a kind of a crazy person. And he's trying to communicate with that guy, but he is sort of elusive. He's talking in riddles and he's laughing. He's like, oh my God, you just stayed awake. Boy, do you wait till you find out what's really going on here. Sort of the gist of what Kiefer's character is saying. And then he sees these guys dressed in black trench coats with these black hats on. Almost identical to the conspiracy movie that's on YouTube of the two guys that walk in the hotel with the black hats and the black trench coats that are seem to have gigantic bodies but little tiny heads. It's on a surveillance video. When they interviewed everybody at the hotel, they said, oh yeah, they were really strange. They didn't blink. They were massive bodies but small heads. They almost looked like twins. I mean, it's a really weird story because all these people from the hotel, at least three people gave testimony about seeing these guys. And they were looking for someone who was staying at the hotel. But they're guys like that. And they start moving people, a bit like the Twilight Zone, which is what Groundhog Day is based on. I forgot the name of it. But they move people around, and they change them, change their positions. So your dad might be your uncle, might be some other dude, the milkman is your dad, or whatever, as soon as you wake up. But some people are the same. He never changes his position. His boss doesn't change positions. And now, once he figures out that this is happening, he's looking forward to every evening happening and trying to figure out what the hell's going on. But in the meantime, as he's awake, he goes in and talks to his boss. And he's like, dude, do you remember last time it was day? Well, of course. He says, when? Because it's night right now and I'm at work. What the hell am I doing at work at nighttime? And the guy's like, you know, he's like a host in Westworld. It doesn't look like anything to me, right? He's like, he can't really figure it out, but he's got all these memories. And then you realize, just like Truman Show, that he has some destinations outside the city that are fabled to exist, but he can't remember really ever being there. He tries to go. And he finds out he can't leave this place. It's like a video game. If you played a video game for any length of time, especially without MMOs where you can keep walking forever, like a Fallout or something, but even Fallout has these moments where you can't go any further. So you can't go that way anymore. But old video games would block off every street with rubble. There's a turned over truck right there and you can't go that direction. It's sort of the way it is. There's a couple Twilight Zones like that too. I'm trying to figure out how far I can go with this one without spoiling it for you guys. That's a pretty good setup. What he discovers is actually fundamental to our question of sort of who are we and where are we? As the possum walks on the fence over there. It's weird. One of our listeners said, I grew up in Huntington Beach. I don't ever remember possums. I'll say, dude, at some point we got infested with them because they're all over the place. But they're so quiet. They only come out at night. But what he reveals is that I don't think this will mess up anything for any of you. And it's just a great movie. The ending is awesome. The ending for me, the guy had me in his hand. Whoever directed this thing, whoever wrote it, right when the stuff starts hitting the fan and the hero starts becoming a hero and starting to kind of solve this issue, I just had all the goosebumps and edge of my seat feelings that they want you to have. So coming to you as a writer, I hope you can appreciate that you'll have that same experience probably. But we have this, and this isn't the ending. What I'm about to say is not the ending, just so you know. It's not what's going on here. But, you know, a lot of us say, we're trying to figure out the shape of the world because NASA lies to us all the time. They've claimed to have, you know, 1,000 satellites so far away from Earth, but orbiting Earth, they should be able to give us 1,000,000 pictures of Earth every single day of our lives. They can't produce one. It's not a composite. The guy at NASA says, pictures of Earth have to be a composite. They have to be a composite. Or it's a composite they have to be, right? That's their official video. It's their official information. But there's that Matrix team, the Matrix folks that are kind of like, well, if it's a Matrix, we could be anywhere. Now, hopefully you realize that the guys in black are the ones in control, but their objective is pretty cerebral. And I think it took me 2 times seeing the film before I really understood the depth of what they were saying. But it's a great film. A lot of people haven't seen it. I'm willing to bet you could get it for almost nothing. If you rented it, it'd be $3.99. But for those of us who've seen it, it really does grow on you over time. It's a brilliant little piece of filmmaking. Now, it occurred to me while I'm talking here that there's another movie that I don't know if it has quite the attribute of not being seen or having been forgotten. But the original Body Snatchers is pretty cool. I just mentioned Kiefer Sutherland. I thought about his father and Donald Sutherland. He's in the very first Body Snatchers. And it's a remake from the original. But they did it in, I think, the 70s. I'll look it up. Yeah, 1978. That's what it says here. It's shot in San Francisco, as a matter of fact. So I hadn't seen it for a long time, and I'd lived in the Bay Area for 12 years, and then moved back down here to Southern California. Then I saw it again down here, and it's all like Pier 39 and all this crazy stuff. But it is a really well-done film where these pods are falling out of space, and they are replicating us. And so they kill you, and then they replicate you in these pods, and then, of course, the replicant walks around and can't speak English and is sort of like this creature that can make more of these folks, right? They'll kill you, and they're part of the process. So the ecosystem is taking over Earth by these sort of organic human creatures. It doesn't have a giant takeaway that would be part of our truth movement or anything, but it's definitely a good film. But here's what's interesting. Now, pulling back from these movies, for me, these films, in part, not all of the films I mentioned, but I think Forbidden Planet, I think The Day the Earth Stood Still, I think Rollerball, and probably Brainstorm, at least. We're talking about some of the greatest moments in filmmaking especially science fiction filmmaking, which usually don't draw on the females, but it is a point where artists slash writers slash filmmakers, actors, all these individuals working together to pull these things off, the people who do the scores half the time, right? They are seeing the future. They are super enlightened people that, you know, if I told you, okay, well, the day the Earth is still is about an alien that comes down with all the information, we're stupid, we shoot it, we kill it, then he stops the Earth to teach everybody a lesson and get everyone on the same page, you're like, yeah, whatever, it's been done a million times. But this is 1951. It's the first time it's been done like that. Now stories, written stories and books and these sci-fi rags that used to be back in those days probably have touched on it before the film was made. I haven't read everything in the world, so I don't know. But the insightfulness is, and the creativity to have a medium that is traveling to another planet. I mean, imagine someone says, hey, we need a sci-fi film. Write a sci-fi film. Okay, yeah, sure, whatever. And of course, back in the 50s, you had X-1, 2000 plus. You had tons of sci-fi rags that were being published out of Los Angeles and New York, and some of the best writers in the world, Robert Heinlein, Asimov, Ray Bradbury, Philip K. Dick was coming online around that time. You know, everyone who wrote The Twilight Zones, Charles Beaumont, Earl Hammer, Rod Serling, all these amazing writers are cranking this stuff out left and right. We do have that DNA still to this day. Just the writing on Westworld alone should prove something to you. The writing on Black Mirror should be phenomenal. I haven't seen any of the new Twilight Zones. I almost need the Twilight Zone reboot, which is like the third or fourth reboot, to work before I go in, because I'd hate to be disappointed. Amazon paid for a reboot of a lot of Philip K. Dick novels, and I tried to watch it, and it's just such a... Let's just put it this way. Without criticizing it, I will just simply say Black Mirror is so blowing that show away, it's hard to watch anything less than Black Mirror. With Rollerball, I'm sitting here watching it come true. I'm living it. You're living it. They're trying to kill the individual. They're trying to use corporations as these savior mechanisms, right? Apple Computer is going to save the fucking world, right? The Notre Dame burns down and they put that something, I'm going to help rebuild Notre Dame. Well, the whole place is being retrofitted for like $6.5 million, and now they've raised $3 billion to rebuild Notre Dame. Hey, I want the place rebuilt too. Don't get me wrong. Thank God the Sistine Chapel, did not burn down. Michelangelo's artwork, that would be blasphemous to the history of this world. It ain't just a building. I have a whole series on screenwriting in this channel. I haven't done a new one in a really long time. I probably will here shortly do another, probably just recap on how to write one quickly, who to go to get educated, and then some of the... just some of the mechanisms that I haven't found being taught. It's like they all want to covet something about screenwriting. It just pisses me off. They just want to be the only guys in town that can do it. And it's like, you know how many stories we're missing because people aren't writing stories that they have because they don't know how to do it? When I write something, typically I'm trying to write some very meaningful things, no matter what script I'm writing, whether it's a dramatic comedy, which I just finished a new one. I really want you to get something out of it morally and for you to see yourself in it. I think Tron and Blade Runner, of which two movies I don't need to mention because they're so well absorbed by the audiences out there. If you haven't seen the 1982 Tron, it has Jeff Bridges in it and Bruce Boxleitner. I mean, David Warner. I mean, some just phenomenally legendary actors. If you haven't seen it, I mean, it really shows you this relationship for those of you who believe in the Matrix. And again, Tron Legacy has none of this, so spare me. It's a pretty film, it sounds great, but the story was abysmal, which is why the reboot is having such a hard time. The sequel. I'm here to tell you that Tron 3, if it happens, it'll be a reboot. It'll just be called 3. It'll be probably called a different name, but I don't know if you can reboot that franchise in the modern day. I posted my version of Tron 3, the screenplay, on the Facebook group in case any of you want to read it. I'm going to read some of my writing. So Tron, just to finish that up, you know, its big contribution is this relationship between programmers, which are considered gods, and the user, which are called users, and the programs that are down inside the computer. So they don't have knowledge of what our world is like, and so they think we're gods. And so when Jeff Bridges goes inside the computer, he's a god, he's a user. But he conceals that because he knows they're going to freak out if he tells them. Blade Runner, I don't know if it has a gigantic takeaway. Definitely probably not as profound as Tron 1982, but Blade Runner is one of the most beautiful films ever created, ever. It is. So is Tron, for a completely different reason. Tron 82 is sort of your amalgamation of, you know, Steven Lisberger, who wrote and directed it, had Lisberger Studios in Boston. He moved it to Venice Beach. He ran that for 10 years. He was doing all your Bubblicious commercials, all the McDonald's commercials. He was sort of revered inside the Disney franchise as being the next Walt Disney. And I can tell you that's probably what would have been the case had they endorsed him fully. But it had Alan Shaw, Richard Taylor. You know, a lot of these guys are super good friends of mine. Bill Croyer. I mean, there's just countless people. I'm missing all these amazing people that contributed to that film. It's the first three-dimensional CG film with live action mixed with it. It didn't happen again until, I believe, Terminator 2. So you're seeing, the reason why it's beautiful is because you have all these guys from the 60s and 70s that are at the top of their game, creating a product that is the very top of their youthful minds. Some of the most beautiful interiors you've ever seen in CG has Sid Mead and Mobius from France, the crazy heavy metal artist. You know, heavy metal's a movie you got to see too, but it's a bunch of skits, so it doesn't really apply to this episode. So you have the best, two of the most incredible designers in the world designing all your visuals. You have this incredible mind of Lisberger, who wrote the film. Little piece of trivia. This is going to be a piece of trivia that I think needs to be exposed. I won't say how I figured this out. But the screenplay of Tron 2, or Tron, sorry, Tron 1982 has two credits on it. It was only written by one person, and he directed and wrote the film. The reason why there's two credits on it is that the day that it was copyrighted with the Writers Guild of America, the person who carried the script to the registration office put their name on it. Unbelievable balls on this chick. She did not write that film. All right? That film has, we have the complete proof of its lineage. It was written over 5 years at the Lisberger Studios. And we have a notebook with all the proof that this script was completely fleshed out. I mean, yeah, there's little technical things here. People massage something here and there. So at most, you might have an additional writing credit, but definitely not a principal writing credit. So there's only one dude who wrote that film. And he's written 20 films since then, okay? But Blade Runner, another Sid Mead creation. Sid Mead probably did 80% of the artwork. The other artists were badass artists. I mean, they got to do Deckard's gun. Most of the branding in the movie is the original branding, not the Coca-Cola and the Pan Am that's in it, but all the other cool sort of renegade symbolism was done by these other artists, and they did a phenomenal job for them interpreting Sid's artwork. Sometimes they couldn't afford to do it all, so, you know, they make modifications to it. Same thing happened to Sid's work in 1982. But that's an heirloom of filmmaking. It'll never be made like that again. Tron 1982 will never be made again like that again. And we wouldn't want to make it the old-fashioned way. But some of the frames in Tron 1982, just as a little bonus round for you guys on this episode, have 28 frames of clear coatless. I think that's the way you say it. But it's this clear plastic that they would put various elements on, and so they would stack up. I think the minimum frame has about 8 layers of this stuff, and the most advanced frame, when you have the, what is it, Bridges' character, Flynn, is kissing Yori inside the computer just as he leaves with the master control program swirling in the background. It's this beautiful scene where they're kissing. I believe that goes all the way up to 28 layers of this codeless stuff. where they're painting their eyes and their teeth separate, and you know, the whole thing was filmed in black and white. And so then that allowed them to color things. But the meticulous hands-on crafting of all the suits, the circuitry, all that was done by hand, utterly phenomenal. Yeah, I mean, I just want to inspire you guys to go take a look at these films. I'm putting this in the normal count of the episodes because I think it's something that should... These movies have stood the test of time. All I've done is plagiarize them in this episode. I think that you should see all of these films, if you're a guy, especially, and you like science fiction. I do think most of them have something you could take away from them. But I would love to hear your suggestions. One of the other ones I love is the original Planet of the Apes with the Rod Serling ending. Unbelievable. Crazy amazing soundtrack. Amazing, amazing soundtrack. Now, again, I didn't mention that because everyone's seen that. Everyone's seen 2001 A Space Odyssey. Most people have seen Clockwork Orange. So, you know, all the Star Wars, all the Star Treks, everyone's already seen all those. So you don't need some guy telling you to go see the obvious. So hopefully you enjoy those films. Go out and see them. Let me know if you haven't seen them and you do see them. Come back and let us know what you thought about it. Try to find the greater details. And I would almost say, unless you're going to see these films in a very contained quarantine environment, you're in your office, you're at your house, kids are out doing something, the wife's content, she's cool into these films too, or whatever the case is, your husband, if you're a lady, excuse me. If you can't see it in that type of quarantine environment, give yourself two watches for whatever film you're going to review, because there's more stuff in them usually. It's pretty cool. So anyway, if you haven't been to deepthoughtsradio.com, please go. That's where you're going to get the audio, the video, in case you want to do it in an iPod. A podcast version of it. We have a locked Facebook group of some of the coolest people, as I always say. We have a Twitter account. I'm keeping things pretty up to date. I let the podcast drift behind two or three episodes. I've been bursting them out. So hopefully you guys who've been patiently waiting on the podcast side, you're enjoying the six or seven episodes that you hadn't heard of because you don't go into YouTube. We also have two ways to donate. We've got the Patreon page and the PayPal page. So you guys can have some fun with that if you dig contributing to the show. For everyone who does financially contribute, you guys are passing links around. We did hit 4,000 subscribers over the last weekend here. It's really nice to see a big even number on the front of that thing after so many months sitting at 3,000. So hopefully the 4,000 will inspire more people to join. But if you could, you know, pass the show around. Because we're learning from everyone, you know, because you're going to cast this net out there and, you know, let's say you cast it out there and say 10 of your friends watch it. I'm assuming that maybe three will find it their style at most, but those three minds will lock on and contribute in the comments. And again, I don't always say it, but one of the most rewarding things you could do, and a lot of you guys are great about it, get into the comments and get in with each other. Please be kind to each other. Because we are trying to rebuild the world into a beautiful sense. Now, there's going to be touchy subjects that will come by every once in a while, so I don't expect everyone to completely be on their best behavior all the time. But, boy, if we could make this a little practice ground, I think it'll help each one of us individually. It certainly helped me quite a bit. So, thanks for showing up. Many more episodes to come. But in the meantime, take care of yourself and someone else, and I'll see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over now.